race, class, gender. It is the holy trinity of charged political particles, the intersection of which define, describe, and bedevil our culture. Composer George Gershwin dove headlong into the heart of this dark and often violent nexus when, in the early 30s, he approached poet and novelist DuBose Hayward about transforming Hayward's popular novel Porgy into an opera. Could they have known, as they began, how powerfully audiences and artists alike would respond to what would eventually be hailed as America's first great opera and simultaneously decried as a racist, stereotyping, and degrading minstrel show?
The puzzle of Porgy and Bess continues to challenge us to this very day, a day during which the social, political, and economic questions it raises, both on purpose and inadvertently, are as potent and explosive as they've ever been.
One thing is certain, though. The full scope and grandeur of Gershwin's towering score didn't become truly a part of the discussion until very late in the game, it having been unfairly foreshortened and edited extensively from the moment of its very first performance on Broadway.
Surely any discussion of the merits of the work requires that the work itself be fully heard and understood.
Incredibly, by most measures, it wasn't until 1976 when the Houston Grand Opera undertook to perform and record the full unabridged Porgy and Bess that moment would arrive. I'm Julian Fleischer, and today I'm talking with the Grammy Award-winning producer of that recording, my friend Tom Shepard.
Hi, Julian.
Hi, Tom. I'm very glad to be here with you again in the studios of WNYC and QXR to discuss yet another one of your remarkable landmark recordings. Gershwin. Is there a greater composer in the history of American music?
Not for me, there isn't. I think he's absolutely the 20th century master composer who could work both in a pop style and a Broadway style, and then, I shouldn't say both, I should say in all three, and as a very legitimate classical composer.
Often he did all three at the same time.
Yes, he did, and Porgy and Bess is a great example of that.
Now, is it true, essentially, that before this recording that you produced, it had never really truly been heard?
It's a little bit of an exaggeration. There was a recording that Lauren Mazel did the year before, which was complete, but it wasn't particularly idiomatic. The best recording was the one made in the early 50s that Lehman Engel conducted and that the great Goddard Lieberson produced for records. That recording is not quite complete, but it's complete enough that for me as a teenager, it was an absolute ear opener. It was just a fantastic experience. I realized that a recording could be much more than just a replication of people standing in front of a microphone in a studio. A recording could be something that if you chose to, you could close your eyes and put yourself into the theatrical environment.
So you were working for RCA at the time, am I correct?
That's right. It was 1976. My God, that's 40 years ago. And I had been at RCA for 2 years. I was vice president of Red Seal. Red Seal encompassed both the classical recordings at RCA as well as the Broadway show recordings. I was able to fairly well pick and choose the artists and projects that we did, you know, just so long as I didn't make an idiot of myself. Yes, I saw Porgy and Bess, the Houston Grand Opera, and it was fantastic. I've never seen anything that was cast so beautifully, directed so beautifully, with a terrific orchestra conducted by a guy, John Demain, who you knew just really felt this score under his skin. And I was determined that somehow I would persuade Sherwin Goldman, who was the man who brought the show from Houston to New York, that the recording would come to us at RCA.
I've been listening to it extensively over the past few days, and it is quite staggering how sweeping it is. Not just musically, but aurally. And I've come to recognize your touch now after having spent so much time listening to your recordings in this past month. I know that pre-production is a big part of what a producer does, especially on a project as large as this. What were some of the considerations going into this project before you actually hit record?
Right near the beginning of the show, right after this very brief overture, which is a virtuosic piece really for xylophone, the show goes into Jazbo Brown. Jazbo Brown is a character we never see, but Jazbo Brown has to be a good jazz pianist. Now, the fellow who played it in the show was really a very good pianist. He's an old friend of mine, a college chum, named Ross Reimuller. But I had recently been working with Dick Hyman. We had done the complete music of Scott Joplin. And I thought, wouldn't it be a terrific idea if a great American jazz pianist actually played the Jazbo Brown music? So, of course, I had to clear this with the producers of the show, etc., but they were fine with it. Ross was fine with it. So the next thing was, okay, what kind of piano was he going to play it on? If he plays it on a good studio piano, that's too classy.
Mm-hmm.
If he plays it on a barrel house piano, that's too shticky.
Mm-hmm.
So what you need is, you need a piano that's sort of okay. Well, we found it. In one of our producer's offices, there was a perfectly ordinary, somewhat out of tune, but not terribly out of tune piano.
Well, let's not delay a moment longer. Let's cut right to the chase with the song that doesn't technically open the opera, but which essentially does. It's the first real song in the opera. It's a lullaby sung by a mother to her baby.
And that's Clara. Clara has an important role in Porgy and Bess, but nothing compared to what Porgy and Bess themselves have. And when Gershwin first wrote this and Anne Brown was playing Bess, the one thing she missed very, very much was that Summertime wasn't her song. So Gershwin created a reprise of Summertime later that Bess herself could sing.
The opera is full of those recurring leitmotifs.
Absolutely chock full of using motifs over and over as they relate to the characters who might have first sung them.
Which was something we think of Wagner doing more than any other, but Gershwin was a student of all sorts of music, so he knew well enough how to use that technique to tell a story. So let's listen to Betty Lane singing Summertime. That was Betty Lane singing Summertime from George Gershwin's epic Porgy and Bess, a landmark recording produced by my friend Tom Shepard, with whom I sit today. That song, it's like, it's one of those songs, it's like Old Man River or Somewhere Over the Rainbow, or I don't know, Climb Every Mountain, that just sort of sounds like it was always there. He carved it out of the rock.
Absolutely, and like so many others that you mentioned, it comes very near the beginning of the show. Curiously enough, the whole first act of Porgy and Bess has lyrics only by Dubose Hayward, not by Ira Gershwin. And Steve Sondheim had an interesting thing to say. He said part of the genius of Dubose Hayward's lyrics is that it says summertime and the living is easy, not summertime where the living is easy or how the living is easy or gee, the living is easy. He said it's just the most appropriate word to, I guess, slowly and lazily connect the two images, summertime and the living is easy.
So you were mentioning while we were listening to that, Tom, that you very subtly bring her closer throughout the course of that song.
That's right, I do, because I started her out from a great distance because I wanted to convey that this was something of a lonely woman in a room somewhere, I guess it was upstage right. But in kindness to the listener, it seemed to me that as she went along, she ought to be a little bit more distinctive. So I, through engineering tricks, brought her about halfway down. It's not as though I brought her to the forefront, but I guess I kind of got her out of that window and at least down the stairs.
I am Julian Fleischer.
I am Thomas Z. Shepard.
And we are enjoying a conversation today about Thomas's recording of Gershwin's Porgy and Bess.
It's a pleasure to be with you again, Julian.
There's no doubt that this opera slash musical spawned a whole raft of great American standards.
Yes, they are hit tunes, absolutely.
Which is part of what's so fascinating about the show is that in the midst of all this very highfalutin composing, he still manages to churn out Gershwin songs.
That's right.
You know, which are the form the backbone of the Great American Songbook.
Right. And let's face it, Julian, this show, opera, musical, would not be a success or as long-lasting as it is if it didn't contain this extraordinary quantity of just beautiful songs that can stand on their own.
As most operas must. Now, I know most of these through other artists, and my favorite interpreter of the songs from this show is Sammy Davis Jr. His versions of Boat That's Leavin' and I Got Plenty of Nuttin' are my favorites. But here we get to hear Donny Ray Albert as Porgy singing it in the way in which it was originally intended.
This is the first time we see that Porgy has become happy. He hasn't been a happy camper up to this point.
And why is he happy?
Because he and Bess are an item.
Oh, I got plenty of nothing, and nothing's plenty for me. I got no car, got no mule, got no misery. The folks with plenty of plenty got a lock on their door. Afraid somebody's going to rob him while he's out a-making more. What for? No use complaining. Ha! Got my girl.
That was the glorious Donny Ray Albert singing I Got Plenty of Nuttin' as Porgy from Porgy and Bess. Now, I was introduced to the song by Sammy Davis Jr., who recorded it even though in the movie he played Sport and Life and did not sing I Got Plenty of Nuttin'. He sings There's a Boat That's Leaving Soon for New York.
It's a fantastic performance that he gives in that film as Sport and Life. I mean, just watching him, as it were, slither up and down the walls. He also had a way of saying the words come with me in the song There's a Boat That's Leaving Soon for New York, a very seductive, compelling way where you really feel him urging Bess on.
Come with me.
All these years later, when I had the chance to make this recording, I asked Larry if he had ever seen the film. He said he didn't think he had. I said, well, there's a particular way that Sammy Davis Jr. sings the lines, come with me. It's very seductive. And I tried to, in my own inimitable way, sing it for him, not very successfully, but he understood the principle of it. And he actually, on the recording, tried his best to do his impression of my impression of Sammy Davis Jr. singing Come With Me.
Come with me. That's where we belong, sister.
Now, this song occurs rather late in the show.
Very late in the show. Sport and Life throughout Porgy and Bess has been a thorn in everyone's side. First of all, he peddles dope. He has a way of ridiculing and mimicking people, which is very, very offensive. And it seems pretty clear that he has no sexual interest in Bess, but he sure as hell thinks of her as a very good business commodity. She's beautiful and she's seductive, and he thinks that they can both make money from that. So when it appears that Porgy himself is in jail, and we don't know if and when he'll get out because he's in jail, supposedly as a material witness to the murder of Crown, Sport and Life is able to prey upon Bess's insecurity and to convince her that the best thing she could do with her life was to get out of Catfish Row and go to New York, where he can buy her the swellest mansions and they can go strutting and there's nothing too good for you. He's telling her that together they can make a fortune in jewels and furs if she just leaves Catfish Row and goes to New York with Sport and Life. And in fact, she does.
He's sort of like the serpent in the garden who is seducing this rather innocent pair of lovers.
That's a wonderful analogy. Yes, he's the serpent.
Score one for Fleischer, a marvelous analogy. And here is Larry Marshall singing, "There's a boat that's leaving soon for New York."
There's a boat that's leaving soon for New York. Come with me. That's where we belong, sister. You and me can live that high life in New York. Come with me. Yeah, you can't go wrong, sister. There's a boat that's leaving soon for New York.
There's a boat that's leaving soon for New York, sung by Larry Marshall with Klama Dale in the Houston Grand Opera 1976 Grammy-winning production that you, Tom Shepard, produced. Tell me what's going on in the story here.
Bess is being seduced by Sport and Life to take some happy dust. He's trying as hard as he can to get Bess to go with him to New York. Bess has already said she's off of that stuff. What you hear with the various footsteps and door closings is that Bess runs away from Sport and Life and shuts the door to her house. And Sport and Life then, instead of giving up and going away, he decides, well, maybe you'd like another shot. And what he does is he takes the happy dust on a piece of paper and he slides it under her door in her house. And what you then hear is Bess, you're not quite sure whether she's crying, sobbing, or sniffing, but it's some combination of all of these, and it becomes very clear that she, in fact, cannot resist. And she takes the dope. It makes her very high and very loud. She opens her door very, very loudly and comes storming out, laughing, and Sport and Life starts laughing, and the two of them are both very high, and you hear them really leave the stage. These two people are Going to New York.
And the music that's blaring behind them is the melody of There's a Boat That's Leaving Soon for New York, and that's how the tune ends, triumphantly for him.
Exactly.
That's his, you know, sort of battle cry, and he's won the battle, he takes her with him, and the music declares a battle won. I'm interested also in the melody that he sings when he leaves the happy dust for her.
All right, I'll leave it, yeah.
The melody from It Ain't Necessarily So, a song he has sung earlier to essentially mock the denizens of Catfish Row for their piety, which he sees as silly and absurd.
And which George Gershwin apparently saw as somehow reminiscent of his Jewish heritage. It's my belief that this was completely intentional because the song is about the Bible. The song is about religious belief. It's about superstition. I don't know what the extent of Gershwin's religious beliefs were, but he was obviously raised in a Jewish tradition on New York's Lower East Side, and he had to have been familiar with
Baruch Hu et Adonai HaMevorach.
I have no doubt in my mind that whether it was for irony or for humor or for wit or for, boy, this looks like fun, he very deliberately based this song on a Hebrew chant.
It's actually the Hebrew chant specifically that you chant before you read from the Torah itself. You know, it makes great sense that this would be the melody he chooses in order to sing about where the Bible lets you down.
Absolutely.
It ain't necessarily so.
It ain't necessarily so.
The things that you're liable to read in the Bible, it ain't necessarily so. Taint Nessa.
That was Larry Marshall as Sportin' Life singing It Ain't Necessarily So from Gershwin's Porgy and Bess, the focus of this episode of For the Record. I'm Julian Fleischer.
And I'm Tom Shepard.
Tom, correct me if I'm wrong, but we have now ventured into the lyrics of Ira Gershwin with Act Two of Porgy and Bess.
That's absolutely right.
Now, Ira Gershwin obviously had other influences on the legacy of this piece beyond his contributions to the lyrics.
Yes, he did. One of the most important things he did was to stipulate that Porgy and Bess should be sung by only black actors, with the exception, of course, of the two or three white characters who George Gershwin decided would not sing. The black people sing, the white people do not have that poetic sense. They can only speak in prose.
Ooh, I like that. They play cops and detectives.
Exactly so.
So they come in as oppressive forces, and they are drawn in distinctly black and white hues when the actual protagonists are drawn in full color.
Yes.
Lisa. He didn't leave any burial issues.
Come here, boy. I'm looking for a man by the name of Porgy. Which is his room? Come, don't you know Porgy?
No, sir.
What is your name?
Just Porgy.
Welcome back to For the Record, Porgy and Bess. I'm Julian Fleischer.
And I'm Tom Shepard.
And today, Tom, we're talking about one of your proudest accomplishments, this recording of Gershwin's Porgy and Bess, perhaps the first truly authoritative recorded account of this opera.
I choose to believe that's true.
And you have a Grammy for your efforts?
Yes, I do, as does the cast and the conductor.
That was the best opera recording of 1977.
Isn't it interesting that it qualified without any difficulty as best opera, not best musical comedy?
Well, if this recording isn't a testament to how much of an opera this thing is, then nothing would be.
How true.
Tom, let me ask you, was this an emotional experience for you and the cast?
In many ways, the most telling emotional moment was about 6 months after the recording was made. I invited the cast and the conductor to my office because it had taken us almost that long. By us, I mean Jay Sachs and myself to do all the editing and mixing. It was a rather complex job. And when Klamadale came into the office and sat down among other people and then listened to I Loves You, Porgy, she started to cry. I wasn't quite sure why she cried, and I hoped very much that it wasn't because there was something wrong with the way we represented her on the recording. We let it finish. She was bathed in tears, and so I asked her, what's happening? She said, well, my father died not long ago, and how I wish he could be here to hear this now.
And there's so little, sadly, written for African-American sopranos.
Yeah, legit sopranos, right. Operatic sopranos.
And this song would be among, you know, one of the great pieces in their repertoire for them.
Absolutely.
So for her to get this shot and to live it so completely must have been overwhelming.
I was very moved by her all the way through. I just loved her. I mean, she was beautiful. She sounded beautiful. And she embodied Bess, you know, when she did it. I was gassed.
I want to.
Loves You, Porgy, sung by Klamadale in the 1976 Houston Grand Opera's recording of Gershwin's Porgy and Bess. I'm Julian Fleischer.
I'm Tom Shepard.
And Tom, you are the producer of this landmark recording and this room's resident expert on the subject of Catfish Row. What is happening in Porgy and Bess at this point?
We learn a lot about Bess right now because on the one hand, she absolutely does love Porgy. She has grown to love him. On the other hand, she cannot resist Crown from a purely animal, physical level. And she says to Porgy very honestly, I'd like to stay with you. But when Crown comes by, he hypnotized me. And she said, if you can keep me, I wants to stay here. And it's just the most self-revelatory and beautiful moment in this very beautiful opera.
Things, however, are about to get stormy.
Yes, things, however, thank you. Things are about to get very stormy because a hurricane comes through Catfish Row. And if a hurricane comes through Catfish Row, it means it probably also came through the waters in which the fishermen who live at Catfish Row are fishing in at this very moment.
So this was something remarkable for you to record, I assume.
I wanted to make sure that I captured the terror of the scene. Some of it is through the well-placed screams that the cast made. Some of it is because of the wind that we kept blowing in and out of it. Some of it, of course, is Gershwin's absolutely wonderful background music. And then there are other things that happen in it. For example, Crown comes back and starts pounding at the door, which the rather superstitious people in Catfish Row think that maybe this is God's vengeance coming to call personally. So it's a very emotional and exciting moment, and this is one of those instances where you hear music, because this is a complete recording, that you may never have heard before, because most recordings of Porgy and Bess treat it like a musical and record the 12 hit songs. But the Gershwins wrote it as an opera. An opera has background music. An opera has musical moments that serve to emphasize the drama of the situation. And that couldn't be clearer than it is in this storm scene.
That was producer Tom Shepard's masterful work recording the storm sequence from Porgy and Bess. It really demonstrates the epic power of this opera to tell a story not just through its legendary hit songs, but the interstitial music that's so essential to its impact. You are listening to For the Record, Porgy and Bess. I'm Julian Fleischer.
And I'm Tom Shepard.
And we have now arrived at Act 3 of Gershwin's legendary opera. The storm is over, and the residents of Catfish Row are mourning the loss of Clara, Jake, and Crown. Now, all should be well for Porgy without Crown in the picture, but as we learned earlier in this episode, Porgy is asked to identify Crown's body, but he refuses, and he ends up spending a week in jail for his contempt of court.
While Porgy is in the county jail, Sportin' Life manages to convince Bess that Porgy's not ever going to get out of jail, that they're going to string him up. And Bess accepts happy dust once again from Sportin' Life, which is presumably heroin. And she and Sportin' Life go off in like a drunken brawl. You hear them laughing it up and leaving the stage. And then the next thing that happens is Porgy does get released from jail. He comes back, he's looking for Bess, and slowly but surely, the members of the community have to tell him, you're not going to find her. She ran off to New York. And at this very, very touching moment, Porgy says, bring my goat. And they say, what do you want to do this for, Porgy? What do you have in mind? What are you doing? And Porgy said, "Ain't you told me Bess went to New York? I gotta be with Bess. Bring my goat." And they bring the goat to him, and Porgy, this poor guy who has no idea how to get to New York and what he's going to find when he gets there, sings, "I'm on my way," and he leaves the stage heading northward while all of us sit dumbfounded and say, "Oh my God, this poor guy, what is he getting himself into?"
Final, very moving moments from Porgy and Bess. And we are on our way out of this studio. But at the end of the day, it is hard to think of a single critical aspect of American life that Porgy and Bess does not end up addressing, either directly or otherwise, in the writing of it, in the history of it, in the performing of it, the recording of it, the thinking about it. In the age of heightened sensitivity to issues of cultural appropriation and the many tangled tendrils that grow out of that question, it is really good to be able to start with this remarkable, authoritative account of Porgy and Bess, the Houston Grand Opera's complete Grammy-winning recording from 1976, which was produced by my good friend here, Thomas Z. Shepard. Thank you, Thomas.
Thank you, Julian.
For the Record is a production of WNYC, WQXR, and the Jonathan Channel here in New York. The show is produced by Ellie Smerling. Our executive producer is Mike Shobe. I'm Julian Fleischer. Thank you for listening. This has been For the Record, Porgy and Bess.